Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 7:25 p.m. and that is Central, excuse me, that is British summer time. And today is August 4th. Today being Friday is the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off today and thinking about the Dow Gold ratio and what it tells us about secular bull markets. But I think I would also like to weave this into a discussion I had with David Brown yesterday. And it was, I think, really going over to think more about what constitutes a secular bull market. What is what would be required for a third industrial revolution? And are they compatible terms? Can you have a secular bull market without having an industrial revolution? Absolutely. But if you have an industrial revolution, will we have just a profound change in the human condition? And what would that mean for everyone? Well, two things that we know for certain are that the industrial revolutions of the past have created incredible change in human living standards. And we've seen particularly the average life expectancy surge over the last 70 or 80 years. So that's profound. Then so obviously that's good news. Of course, for all the people who get moved around, those that move from the farm to the city, those who move from working in an office to working online, that's obviously a profound change. Some people thrive, others don't, and that is a big part of the individual human's condition. And of course, we all only have our own individual life span. So anyone who's from around middle age upwards is going to be well aware of the kind of societal change and the technological changes that have occurred over the course of the last 30 to 40 years. It's a bit more difficult to explain that to younger people because they just haven't had direct experience of it. And of course, that is part of the human condition. We tend to associate and I give credence more to the kinds of things that we have personally experienced than comparing what's going on today with history. But there are obviously cycles, and of course the most important cycle is our own lifespan. And these kind of contemplations generally tend to happen later in life because most people have then been through a good portion of their lives and seen how much things have changed. Now, if we're in a new industrial revolution, David hypothesized, I think it was as early as 2014, that three important characteristics would be required. That you would need a new money system, you would need a new energy system, and you would need a new transport or communication system. Well, those are the kinds of things that arrived in previous industrial revolutions. But one thing that I think is important to realize is they didn't all happen at the same time. So, for example, the printing press was invented in the 1430s, give or take. And the first steam engine didn't really come along for nearly 200 years afterwards. Actually, it was closer to 300 years afterwards. So that's an awfully long interval if one has to be an investor waiting for an industrial revolution to take place. The reason that I mention it is that the big innovation that we've had over the last 20 years has been in communication. We've had the evolution of the internet, and the internet has greatly facilitated the sharing of information, and it has created and successfully disintermediated supply chains, so that now the number of steps between the manufacturer and the customer have been constricted really quite significantly, and that has allowed a relatively small number of companies to do particularly well, Amazon being the most obvious of those, where it has successfully basically taken over the middleman position. But when we start to see real economic growth taking off and productivity boosting beyond recognition, it's when we get new energy. So the move from peat and animal waste and wood to coal was a massive step, where you get this huge jump in the return on energy expended. And that allowed for the Industrial Revolution to really kick off. So we had the steam engine. Then shortly afterwards, you had the spinning jenny. And then you had steam engines taking over everywhere. That led to the building of the canals. Eventually, it led to metal ships and steam-powered ships. Then the innovation in energy. That we had with the invention of the internal combustion engine was another massive intensification of the energy density of the economy. And we had another massive leap forward. Now, the next question, of course, is where is the next one going to come from? So the big challenge right now is that if we think about the innovations that we've had over the course of the last 20 years, it's really been focused on communications. And first we had the invention of the internet. And then we had the release of 4G. So it was the big 4G companies, the companies that benefited most from 4G have been the big winners. So when we think about Amazon, shopping online is great, but shopping on your mobile, that is wonderful. And something that we've definitely seen with Mrs. Tracy's business is that many of the orders come in around 11, 12, or even 1 o'clock in the morning. And that's because people are shopping in bed. So that's certainly something that is has been a big benefit in terms of their the pattern of behavior and the way that people have been shopping. When we think about Facebook or the other social media properties, and then Alphabet or Google, then they've also benefited enormously from 4G because people have the internet in their hand, and the evolution of the handset as a mode of communication with very fast internet connection, well, then that has allowed Apple to become the biggest company in the world. And then with the evolution of computing power and the requirement for an operating system, Microsoft hasn't been far behind. So that has all been propagated by the evolution of 4G. Now, we have 5G. I was able to record the video last night because I hotspotted from my phone and my phone had 5G connectivity. So that was reasonably seamless. I was a bit worried about the potential that it would drop, but it was really quite impressive. But again, that is all in terms of communication. Even if we think about a company like Tesla, well, that's still within the communication, transportation part of the theme. And one of the key benefits of Tesla, and one of its competitive advantages, is that it can upload software enhancements over the web into all of its cars at once. So there have been multiple occasions where people were talking about the range of their vehicle improved, their battery health improved because of over-the-air updates. And that's certainly something that's been enabled by 4G. So those are all very impressive. And we've had a phenomenal bull market as a result of that. We've had this incredible run higher by those the companies that were the real champions of the 4G movement. Netflix, of course, is another one of those, and the company simply wouldn't exist were it not for the ability to stream movies on one's phone or on TV. We've got lots of examples of that. And then, of course, because every one of those devices needs a chip, NVIDIA has been a fantastic performer, and it continues to be. Now, the next question, of course, is as we look at compute, into which one of those brackets does it fit? Is it communication transportation? Is it going to be more about banking? Or is it going to be more about the evolution of energy? And I think the answer is that it will probably be important for all. So that is one of the primary reasons why we've had this huge run-up. Now, I've put up the Dow Gold ratio because this has been one of the most cyclical trends in the world, and it stopped being cyclical. And the simple hypothesis would have been that we would have had a continued advance in the Dow Gold ratio to a new high, and that new high would have occurred probably sometime around the 2030 mark. So that would imply that the Dow would had pretty much more than double relative, and probably more like triple relative to the price of gold. And that would be consistent with a big secular bull market. Now, the thing that I find rather interesting is that one of the things that has been delivered by the communications bull market has been this incredible availability of access to media. And now the very fabric of what people think of as objective truth is open to subjectivity. And that's obviously something that a lot of people are troubled about, and with good cause. Because we've had this innovation in communication, but what we have not had is an innovation in energy or productivity. So even though we've had this incredible change in our lives, individual productivity has not changed. And the loudspeaker for public discontent and for the kind of disruption to the daily life that has occurred has grown much more accessible. So then we've had a rise in populism. We've had a very clear trend of people voicing their opinions online. And it has turned into a mob-like environment in various social media properties. And it has led to a great deal of stress, particularly for young people, and a lot of, well, I think perhaps a big bull market in psychiatric services. How do we get out of that? How do we get back to I guess, an easier environment? It's about energy and greater energy density. But the challenge, of course, is that what we are now proposing and what governments are rolling in behind is less dense energy. When we see all of the investments that are being put into solar and to wind, that is distributed energy. It is inconsistent with base load demand. Then you need to put up more wind farms. You need to put in storage. What we've definitely seen as well is that the expected output from solar farms is way less than in reality than it is on the prospectus. So that's a significant factor. There's of course also the inconsistency of depending on a weather variable energy source in an environment where one expects weather variability. That doesn't make sense. But I think the more important point is that we are spending a great deal of money putting in the kinds of energy systems that are less energy dense, and what the global economy really needs is an energy source that is far more dense. Then, of course, what this is bringing up is the question of, are we now in an energy environment which is technology led? Or is this going to be resource-led? This is the central argument about where the trend of technological innovation will lead in terms of energy. So we could have, for example, much more sensitive or energy productive solar cells. We could have wind turbines as big as skyscrapers and taller, and that they will be huge generators of electricity. But they're very big installations, one way or the other. And the reality is that what we need is a big leap in terms of energy density. Nuclear energy was a big leap in terms of energy density. And then we stopped building them because there were safety concerns. Now, actual reality is that nuclear is not nearly as dangerous as everyone makes out. And there was a lot of panic, I think, during the Cold War about the potential for nuclear annihilation. So that fear was then passed on to nuclear energy. And activists were very successful in campaigning against it. So there hasn't been nearly the same pace of building. But then we should think about what are the potential the solutions that could deliver greater energy intensity. Well, there's a lot of money starting to move into hydrogen. And mixing hydrogen with ammonia allows it to be transported. And that even allows it to be transported via pipeline. Now, of course, if we're talking about using ammonia as an energy source, how likely is that, considering the smell that would permeate every city in the world? I don't think people are going to take that kind of risk. But, of course, there is always the potential that it could be solved with another kind of technology. But there's money certainly flowing into it. Then we also have small modular reactors. These are basically generation 4 or 5 energy nuclear technology, where the meltdown risk has largely been engineered out, and they would act as remote batteries that could simply plug and play for a decade or more without needing to be refueled. And that's something that could be very beneficial. But it's probably going to be a few years before even the first one is put into commission. They're building it right now. In fact, all of the small modular reactor companies buy their parts from the same company. And I'll come back to the Dow-Gold ratio. But it's Doosan Enerbility is the company in South Korea that supplies all of these companies like NuScale or even Rolls-Royce. And the share is trading almost exactly in the same way as the uranium ETF. So we've had some steadier action in the uranium mining companies. And I think there is a greater acceptance that there will have to be more nuclear building going on. That what we need is energy density. We need abundant, cheap, reliable, and affordable. I think the affordable or cheap the moniker is doubly important, because in order to boost productivity, then economies can't be worrying about energy variability. And we've certainly got energy variability. Oil prices are are still in a very tight environment. And Saudi Arabia is voluntarily cutting back on supply. They are actively supporting the market. Brent crude is marching higher. It's up to $86 now. It has clearly broken the medium-term downtrend. So this is a new recovery overall. It is, I think, very much suggestive of the tight environment. And this could potentially mark some pressure on the global economy going forward. Because a big move higher in energy prices is not great news for the global economy. Now, of course, it is certainly positive for the energy companies. So the spider, the energy spider, continues to advance here. And it's coming up to the upper side of a year-long range. It has broken the 7-month sequence of lower rally highs, and there is the potential here that it can break on the upside. Several of the smaller companies are doing better, and then if there's going to be demand for more oil, then the oil services companies should begin to attract more interest. And the VanEck Oil Services ETF is pushing up to the upper side of its range. And then when we think about, for example, those that have some of the better resources and less leverage, like EOG Resources, then it has popped right back up to test the 140 level. And now it's going to consolidate, or at least it's looking likely to consolidate. But it should perhaps be something considered as a buy the dip type of scenario. Now, as we think then about where energy is variable, there are two important questions. The first is that for the longest time, the supply of energy was assured, even if the price was variable. So natural gas prices spiked higher in 2021 and 2022, and that was directly in response to the war in Ukraine and the boycott of Russian supply. So energy security has become a much more pressing issue. But as we think about the massive debt loads, the acute need for productivity growth, well, we've had a phenomenally impressive move in terms of communication technology. And it has enhanced the productivity for some people beyond recognition. I would consider myself one of those. For many others, it really hasn't had a big impact on their productivity. The thing that really moves the needle in terms of individual productivity is the availability of energy. And natural gas prices are at a low ebb. They're back well inside the base formation and only barely holding here in the upper side of the range. But it would require a significant change in terms of supply in order to see a sustained break back above the $3 level. Now, the other, I think, major potential innovation could be fusion. And there's a lot of money going into developing fusion technology. Some of it will certainly be wasted cash. And I'm very conscious of the fact that the majority of people that are starting up new fusion companies are alumni of MIT. And there were a group of academics at MIT had been playing around with fusion for about 25 years, and then they lost their funding, and the university closed down their tokamak reactor. And then they all started new companies, said that they could build one for about $500 or $600 million, and that they could get it done within 5 years. Well, that was in about 2017 or 2018. We're 5 years forward. There's no sign of the spark fusion reactor just yet. Doesn't mean they can't do it. And there was the announcement that positive net energy was created from a fusion experiment at the end of last year. But they haven't yet been able to repeat it, and they certainly haven't been able to create any kind of machine that can repeat it in short bursts to actually power a grid. So they're still a good long way away from that. So we're still in this environment where we're tied to the demand for energy. We're tied to the volatility, and the big wild card today is about security of availability. So The war in Ukraine continues to escalate, and what we're starting to see now is that Ukraine is targeting civilian targets in Russia by bombing Moscow, and then they've also taken out the bridge, or attempted to take out the bridge to Crimea from Russia. So Russia has hit back in a tit-for-tat manner and tried to destroy their grain export terminals, and then Ukraine did the same thing and attacked Russia's grain export terminals, and indeed they also that also coincides with the same area where Russian oil exports and Kazakhstan exports enter the Black Sea. So that is only going to further create uncertainty about the security of supply. So we're in a rather difficult environment right now, where there is security concerns, but then there's also the promise of really significant technological innovation. So let's then go back and think about the Dow gold ratio. So it did bottom in 2011, and we had a good sized rebound. And since about 2018, it has gone pretty much sideways. So we're certainly in an interesting environment, and it does beg the question, is the Dow gold ratio efficacious any longer? Is it worth relying on? So that then raises additional questions. Is the Dow the most appropriate index to use? Or is gold actually reflective of the broader global economy? So as we then think about these questions, well, we might just look at some of the other potential ratios. So gold is money, and it was money for 100 years. And now the question, of course, is it still a monetary unit? It's certainly not a currency. It certainly has monetary value, and it is it would be accepted just about anywhere. It would have a value anywhere in extremis. And it is a unit of exchange, and it is still held by central banks as a reserve. So it does have monetary value, but it's certainly not money. Of course, oil also has a monetary value. If you have gasoline, you have a product made from oil, then it is transferable for services or for goods just about anywhere. So then let's just think about the NASDAQ gold ratio. And then we're going to get perhaps a more interesting picture. So it's still trending higher. And this, of course, has been the index which has had the greatest evidence of a big new bull market. So the NASDAQ gold ratio is still in an uptrend. Now, it is pulling back a little in here this week, and we could easily see some consolidation. But it's still on the upper trajectory. Now, of course, we had the phenomenally large bull market in the 1990s. And despite the fact that we have the largest companies in the world ever, right now, and you had Apple until yesterday trading at a market cap greater than $3 trillion. This has not been nearly the same intensely bullish environment that we had in the 1990s, because back then it was just about all companies in the technology, media, and telecom sectors were rallying. And on this occasion, it has been just the phenomenon this year that more than half of all stock market performance has been attributable to only 7 companies. So we've had a significant narrowing of breadth over the first half of the year. Now, the big question for the second half of the year is, are we going to see a widening of that breadth? But at least if we're still thinking about secular bull markets, the NASDAQ relative to gold is certainly still efficacious. Now let's then think about the performance of the NASDAQ relative to oil. So oil is another monetary unit, and then we have this potential that or I guess it's not a potential, but there is the petrodollar phenomenon, where the big oil producers have agreed to accept dollars. Now that is changing. But it was the petrodollar system was in evidence for an awfully long time. And we had the phenomenal spike in 2020. So now let's just think about what that means. Maybe it would be better to look at this on a log scale chart. So we can look at plenty of back history. The oil price goes back sufficiently long, at least a couple of decades, so that we can get a picture here. So we had this enormous spike higher, a phenomenal bull market from the low in 2008 all the way up to the peak in 2020 that the technology sector outperformed oil. And then we've had oil outperforming for a couple of years, underperforming over the last year, but now it is potentially beginning to roll over. But if we think about the longer term, well, this is where we still have a great deal of cyclicality, where the technology sector did accelerate to a long-term high in 2020 because oil prices went negative, and then subsequently the ratio has been coming back down. So that suggests that we should at least give some credence to the potential that energy will outperform at the broader stock market for the lengthy medium term. Now, of course, when we think about uncertainty, and we've seen plenty of evidence of uncertainty of energy supply, but of course, we also have uncertainty about the supply of currency. So the willingness of the US government and politicians to weaponize the dollar is enhancing the argument for countries to put less faith in the US dollar, and that there is a clear movement underway to try and de-dollarize international trade. But of course, that's not an easy task, and it's something that could play out over an exceptionally long period of time. So the de-dollarization trend, I don't think it's going to emerge immediately, but it's certainly going. It's underway, and more countries, particularly those that are, I think, directly opposed to the U.S. hegemony, then they will be very eager to not use the dollar in cross-border transactions. So we've definitely got this big question then about, are we going to see technology outperforming? Are we going to see commodities outperform? And then, if we are going to see commodities outperform, which ones? So I think a lot of that is going to come down to what happens with the dollar. And I do want to bring this back into the bigger question. In terms of the third, or depending on how one defines it, fourth, I know that the World Economic Forum talks about the fourth industrial revolution. But I think if, as we think about that, there is the potential for massive productivity enhancements depending on how the technology of the energy sector evolves and how banking evolves. Now, we've had lots of promising developments in the banking sector, and we've had crowdfunding, for example. We've had the evolution of crypto. We've had online banking, and those are significant. But by far the most important financial innovation that we've had over the last 15 years has been quantitative easing. And the fact that governments have been printing money like it's going out of fashion and are running up deficits with really no regard for how the money is going to get paid back. That's particularly true of the USA. And then central bank balance sheets surging higher. Well, that is that has created this stealth inflation where asset prices have increased, but wages didn't move. And that just lowered living standards. So it was basically savers were really made uncomfortable relative to borrowers or for our investors. And that is an additional point that when you have this massive secular bull in communications technology, where people have plenty of room to vent, and then they experience lower living standards, well, then that does create social discontent, which is exactly what we've had. The one thing that I've noticed in particular while being in the UK over much of the last month has been the number of people I've seen jumping the turnstiles on the tube. I lived in London for 7 years between 2000 and 2007, and I don't think I ever saw anybody do it, and I've seen it 3 times today. When prices go up and wages don't go up, and at the prices that are being charged, people feel are unfair, then that creates an incentive to simply not pay at all. And we see the same thing in terms of shoplifting. And that was certainly true in California. So they even decriminalized it because they just simply could not keep on top of the pace with which it was taking place. So obviously that was not a wise move. And simply giving up on policing is seldom a good idea. And I think Oregon, with their failed experiment with decriminalizing drugs, is perhaps learning that now, or hopefully will learn that. But the reality is that we've had this enormous amount of cash printed. Now, the dollar was exceptionally firm from the low back at the end of 2020 until the latter half of 2022. And now it has encountered resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average in here today. So the economic statistics, they weren't greeted with a great deal of enthusiasm today. So you had the change in non-farm payrolls were still positive, but not as good as expected. The unemployment rate actually went down. And then average hourly earnings were in fact higher than expected. And the labor force participation rate didn't move at all. So, and then of course we have the underemployment rate, which came down a little. So this is still an environment where we have a reasonably solid economic environment for the US economy. And inflation hasn't quite yet come back down, but it's coming down. And I think it's going to continue to trend down. So there is obviously then the potential that what we can anticipate is that inflation will come back down and that it could surprise on the downside. That has been my contention from probably the end of last year. And I'm still sticking with it because I think it's the most likely scenario. Now, the yield curve spread is attempting to bottom. The 10-year minus the 2-year is not nearly as sensitive as the 10-year minus the 3-month. So we don't have clear evidence just yet that it has bottomed, but it did bounce rather impressively in here this week. Now, for a secular bull market, what you need is liquidity. And there was obviously a huge swell of liquidity provided to anyone who wanted to borrow from about 2008 until 2022. Then yields started to rise. And now the yield curve spread looks like it is bottoming when we look at the 10-year minus the 3-month, but it's not anywhere close to pushing up through zero just yet. Then we've had this huge amount of money printed during the pandemic, and that has allowed a great deal of resilience in the global economy when you've had the savings rate jump and now it is being eroded. It's down from in the USA from about 8% to 2%. And the one thing that has been a defining characteristic of the US economy has been that when people have money, they spend it. And that's exactly what's going on right now. So, as we think then about what the trajectory is, well, it's reasonable to anticipate that stocks will be firm until the savings rate is expended. And then economic activity will take a meaningful hit because the consumer will be tapped out. And that will lead to a recession. Now, it might take several more months before that occurs, and we're definitely seeing that many of the investment banks have given up on their recession estimates. They don't think now that it will occur in on any time in 2023, and it might push out into the middle of 2024 if it happens at all. What I would caution is that this is exactly what you anticipate happening in the deepest part of the inversion, that people forget about the predictive power of the yield curve. And this is the second stage of the inverted yield curve phenomena. The first is that investors initially get worried about what happens in terms of inflation, and then they rejoice that the central bank is doing something about it by raising interest rates. And then subsequently, stock markets recover. So inflation starts to come down. Interest rates haven't got to a place where they are particularly onerous, and stocks and earnings don't pull back because that's a lagging indicator. So then we see that the yield curve continues to contract. The central bank continues to raise interest rates. They continue to restrict liquidity. Everybody forgets about the predictive power of the yield curve. And then subsequently, the yield curve spread starts to move higher. We're not quite there yet, but we might be approaching that point. And that is when interest rates start to come back down, and investors start to think more about easier monetary conditions. So then you can even have a blow off in terms of performance in stock markets. And that is potentially where we are at the present moment. Then at the long and variable lag of monetary policy starts to be felt. And we start to then see economic activity waning and less demand and some trouble starting to occur within the corporate sector. Now, I think this occasion is a little bit different than we've had in the past because the high yield market, the high yield spread is now back at the lower side of its range. It's testing the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, it's been holding here in the region of the 400 to 500 basis point level for a year. And this is a pretty elevated level relative to the average. Then, in nominal terms, the high yield ETF has been quite weak and is ranging, spent the last year ranging. Now it was a little steadier in here today. It's still encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average, but it still has a sequence of higher reaction lows since the low back in October. So the bounce today has ensured that it's still going to hold on a while longer. But the bigger question here is when the breakout comes, is it going to be on the upside or the downside? And that's going to be very much tied to the outlook for the economy, and it should have a significant bearing on the enthusiasm for assets. So, as we look then at the high yield market, the one important point is it has been fairly resilient in the face of rising interest rates, and that is because there was a huge refinancing trend in 2020. So there's a large number of companies that aren't going to be under pressure to refinance. And that is something that will potentially isolate or potentially insulate the corporate sector from liquidity challenges in much the same way that homeowners are insulated from the inflationary pressures because they've been able to lock in their mortgage rates. Of course, that's a purely US phenomenon, and in the UK, Australia, Canada, lots of other countries, floating rates mean that consumers are not insulated from higher interest rates and they come under severe pressure. Of course, then it's going to be a question within each of those individual countries what percentage of the market even has a mortgage. So, I believe in the UK, it's only about 40% of houses even have a mortgage. That means that there's a good 60% of people, they're not going to be affected in nearly the same way by inflation. So, it's important to look at that particular way of thinking rather than focusing on media attention. And then I think it's also particularly impressive that leverage loans really haven't pulled back at all. So they were in mildly negative territory yesterday, but it's been surging higher for most of the last year. And the total return on leverage loans, you would anticipate that that should pull back if there was real stress coming through within the private company sector. But there are problems. And when we think about those problems, well, so the commercial property sector is where the problems reside. So CBRE being a large commercial property real estate agent, it's been ranging for the last year, but it is firming from the region of the 200-day moving average. We've had a huge jump in interest rates, and the big question is, how long will it be for, or how long will companies be able to continue paying high rents? When will negotiations start? We've had several of the big private equity companies walking away from their portfolios. So that's an effort to refinance. What happens for WeWork, I think, will be one of the bigger events. The company is pretty close to broke. And the share price it has been completely eroded. So it's down to 23 cents from an IPO level around $10. And there's a good chance that the company will go bust and hand back it, the keys to a large number of commercial real estate funds. Of course, that threat means that they have a good chance of renegotiation of those leases. So that, I think, is perhaps the silver lining that some of these companies might actually get to refinance. Now, as we think then about secular bull markets, well, we've had a big swell of money supporting the market from 2008 until 2021. We had a big pullback in response to interest rate sensitivity. And then we had a big rebound as perhaps the selling pressure was overdone in parts of the market, enthusiasm around artificial intelligence, and then also the resilience of earnings. But big bull markets require access to additional new cash. And the recovery from what we are seeing right now is likely to be driven by provision of cash. And where is that likely to come from first? Well, the most likely destination, or I guess origination point for fresh liquidity, will be China. They are looking at a significant retrenchment in the property market, and the chances of China, and considering the size of the overbuild that they have, going down the same road as Japan, is quite high. And that would suggest that Chinese property prices are going to fall as a percentage of GDP over the lengthy medium term. And in order to cushion the blow, then China could engage in the same kind of fiscal expansion that Japan did. And that would be a massive source of additional new cash in the global system. And it could help to propel a global bull market. But until it happens, we're still on the starting blocks. And I think that is most particularly true when we think about copper. Because the price has been exceptionally variable and it's been up and down in a dynamic manner over the course of the last week. It's still hovering here below the $4 level, and it's going to have to sustain a move up through that area in order to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. The major theme over the next decade is likely to be decarbonization. There's an incredible amount of information being propagated right now about the global temperature extremes. Now, when you look at somewhere like Phoenix, Arizona, where they had temperatures of 115 degrees Fahrenheit for 30 days in a row, even for Phoenix, that's hot. There has been exceptionally hot weather in places like the Mediterranean. I think upwards of 45 degrees Celsius in Greece, for example. Now, one of the things that David Brown mentioned was that he's been on holiday in Greece on several occasions, and the incidence of arson is incredibly high. So that arsonists they can use the opportunity provided by high temperatures to set fires. Both to damage their adversaries, but also to claim that it was a natural phenomenon and claim insurance. So it's very hard not to be cynical in this kind of environment, but these are the kinds of events that occur, and they do influence the news flow. And I think as we think about how the temperatures are being recorded, now, there has been some incidents where air temperature and ground temperature were mixed up, but nonetheless, we are definitely seeing very high temperatures and a lot of people in a great deal of distress. Well, the easy answer is that we need more energy. We need more energy provided, more electricity generating capacity built, transmission cables built, and then more in the way of air conditioning installed in anywhere that is susceptible to high temperatures. Now, that alone would be a big infrastructure build. When you then look at the rollout of electric vehicles and the willingness of governments to support that, well, then the volume of electricity that's going to be required will be really rather high. And we're going to need a big investment in generating capacity. So that could be beneficial for copper, but not unless China starts stimulating its economy. It could be beneficial for the solar sector, but that's going to be dependent on subsidies. It could be beneficial for uranium, but the streamlining of regulations and more money being devoted to build programs will also be essential. And of course, the big question then is where will the money come from? So we're still in a tighter liquidity environment, and governments are worried about the toll of inflation on their electability. So it's quite likely that central banks will err on the side of caution and continue to tighten until they have clear evidence that inflation has been beaten. And we've definitely started to see that coming through now in Brazil. They were among the most aggressive in raising interest rates, and now they're starting to cut them. So the Brazilian real is starting to weaken, and they cut interest rates by 50 basis points this week and said that they would continue to cut rates at the next meeting by 50 basis points. And the economic activity in Brazil is starting to flag. So at the fintech sector did not respond the way that I thought it would. And we're starting to see that the fintech companies are coming back down from the lower side of, or from the upper side of, the first step above their little bases. I'm not going to burn for the faith here, and I'll potentially close if I don't see a recovery on Monday, and then look for a better entry opportunity later. Or I might be willing to simply hold and buy more at a more accommodative level and build a position that way. When we think, though, about what that means for the global economy, Brazil was the country that raised rates most. And then they've seen inflation come down fastest. Now the central bank is responding to weakening economic activity and cutting rates. I think that's foreshadowing what we're going to see in much of the rest of the world, where countries did not raise rates as aggressively, had a bigger inflation problem and a more persistent inflation problem. Therefore, they've had to continue raising rates. But eventually, inflation is going to start surprising on the downside, and economic activity will wane, and then they will have to begin to cut. And that is why the dollar is beginning to roll over. So the dollar index pulling back from the region of the 200-day moving average, this is holding out the prospect of a lengthier medium-term decline. And the long-term cyclicality of the dollar, where we have 7-year bull and bear market cycles with a bit of messing around in between, is still very much intact, although the bull trend over much of the last decade is a bit long on the tooth right now. So now prices are coming back down again from the most recent test of the 200-day moving average, and if the dollar index pulls back through 100, then that's likely to be a really pivotal event. What that would then begin to suggest is that ex-US assets are going to attract more interest, that the interest rate that is demanded to hold US Treasuries will be higher. And the 10-year yield had popped on the upside over the last several days, but then started to come back down. So how do we square this? Well, the simple answer is that if the Federal Reserve overtightens and the economy moves into a recession, then demand for bonds will increase. And today's downside Q reversal for the 10-year Treasury is certainly temporarily creating some demand. And I think I should be clear in what I expect. What I expect is that following the inflation trend we've had over the last couple of years, we're going to have a deflationary shock. And the reason I believe that is that every time we've had quantitative tightening, then the natural attitude has been to think that this liquidity isn't going to have a big effect, but it does have a big effect. The first thing that happens during quantitative tightening is that yields go up because investors panic that the central bank is no longer buying them and supporting the market. But then deflationary fears start to evolve, and then yields start to come back down. And on each of the occasions that quantitative tightening has occurred, yields have compressed very abruptly. And that has usually been accompanied by very significant deflationary fears. Now, of course, this is a monetarist's way of thinking about the market, but I think we have plenty of evidence to support it. And I had an investor asking me today while I was during this week why I was still willing to hold on to my long in bonds. It's because I don't really mind what happens to the price right now, because I believe I will be proved correct eventually, and that we're going to have a significant rally in bonds. And when that happens, we're going to see a surprising move. Now, after that, because of that move in bonds, where there's going to be a big compression in yield, well, then that's going to be in response to a growth shock, and central banks will have to act. But the inflation genie is out of the bottle. People are worried, and the inflationary mindset is starting to set in that you need to accelerate your purchases in order to avoid that the rate won't be higher later. So if we start to see more money being printed and asset prices beginning to recover, then we're likely to have shorter, sharper cycles. So I would anticipate that inflation will come back and that the deflationary shock will be replaced by another inflationary wave. And that could easily result in yields moving on to new highs. But that would be after yields compress. And if we are moving more into an environment like the 1970s, we're going to have shorter, sharper cycles. We're going to have a couple of years on the upside and a couple of years on the downside. We're going to have a lot of movement in interest rates. And over that time frame, then the treasury yield will trend higher. And the total return on the, let me see if I can find this. I do apologize. I can't remember, or at least I'm not entirely sure why I couldn't remember that ticker. So the total return on the 10-year treasury has been the most consistent trend in the world, and it's over. So we've had a meaningful decline. Now, I anticipate that the yield is at least going to push back up and test the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and that that might even be starting to happen now. And in response to the move that we've had in the yield curve, where it's beginning to bottom, we might see that the longer end of the curve starts to attract interest, because the shorter end of the curve should then start to contract. And the 2-year yield is still here below the 5% level. And it has not moved to a new high. And that's also a key reversal, or at least a downward dynamic that we're seeing in here today. So as we think about the broader environment, I think we're in for a deflationary shock. And then we're likely to move into shorter, sharper cycles. The trend of technological innovation will persist, and we're going to have surprises. There will be advances in the energy sector. Money is being flowing into it. The first of the small modular reactors will come on a line in probably 2027. If we do have shorter, sharper cycles, we're going to have huge bull trends in between. It will be more of a trader's environment. There will be more opportunity in short bursts, but one will have to be nimble. And I think the expectation that we can expect a decade of quiet markets with big advances, that's, I think, too much to hope for. So I think as we look forward, there will be technological innovation. The Industrial Revolution argument is a big long swing. They can take anything from 25 to 50 years. And I think we are in the middle of a huge innovation. And artificial intelligence and the applications of big data, they're going to be particularly powerful for healthcare. They're going to be particularly powerful for materials science, and that will lead to phenomenal innovation. When we think then about communications technology and the evolution of compute with that artificial intelligence and the need for massive innovation, I think that's very clear. Then for quantum computers, It's not about brute force computing, but about trying to answer high prob or the trying to as ascribe probability to answers will be a much more interesting way of solving problems. It's a completely new form of the computing power, and the pace of innovation there is breathtaking. Coupled with the speed and ease with which the genome can be sequenced, and coupled with the big data that comes through from the healthcare sector, that can greatly extend the human life, and that will also enhance productivity. So enhancements in energy benefit the economy. Enhancements in healthcare benefit people, but both contribute to productivity growth. So as we think about where the bull markets will arise, there will be inspiring stories that come through, but it's on the monetary side which will dictate how well stocks perform. And I think that is probably where we're going to be over the longer term. And I think with that, I'll wish you for well wishes for the weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.